Now, politics, and our two regular guest political commentators, David Brooks of the Weekly Standard and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
I want to play you something from Defense Secretary Rumsfeld's news conference today when he was peppered with questions about the war plan for Iraq. Is it too risky? Is it too light on infantry? Is it too optimistic about an Iraqi surrender? Here's what he said.
The war plan is Tom Frank's war plan. It was carefully prepared over many months. It was washed through the tank with the chiefs on at least four or five occasions.
Exactly.
It has been through the combatant commanders. It has been through the National Security Council process. General Myers and General Pace and others, including this individual, have seen it in a variety of different iterations. When asked by the president or by me, the military officers who reviewed it have all said they thought it was an excellent plan.
Secretary Rumsfeld, and the man who said exactly behind him was General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Is it still regarded as an excellent plan in Washington this week, David Brooks, or aren't we hearing a lot of carping about this plan for Iraq?
There's a lot of carping. I noticed he said it was Tommy Frank's plan and not his own, which is maybe a sign that there's some carping going on. The main carping revolves around the phrase, which we're all supposed to use now, of boots on the ground, which is how many people do you need to take over Baghdad? Rumsfeld came in not necessarily to dictate a specific plan for the military attack, but with a philosophy. And the philosophy was one of transformation, that you didn't need masses of soldiers because of the technology that allowed you to do a lot more things with fewer soldiers. And I think the plan was fundamentally shaped by the Rumsfeldian vision of the world. And some of the brass who don't share the Rumsfeldian vision of the world are now leaking mightily, notably to the Washington Post, saying, wrong, 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 let's get more boots on the ground.
E.J. Dionne?
Well, I think you can tell that the administration is worried about a lot of things first because, as David said, he wasn't taking responsibility for this plan, which he might have done a week ago. Second, the White House and Mr. Rumsfeld and others are starting to complain about the press coverage. Mm-hmm. When they start complaining about the press coverage, something is going wrong. I think specifically on this plan, you're also seeing a lot of reports on Turkey and why did the diplomacy fail in Turkey? And if only they had been successful at diplomacy, you could have had troops come in from the north. So I do think they have a problem. But I was thinking about this today, that the most dangerous punditry can look stupid at many occasions. The most dangerous kind of punditry is in the middle of a war. Yeah. In 1864, Abraham Lincoln in the early summer thought he'd lose the election, and he was a pretty good politician because the war news wasn't very good. Then there were a lot of victories, and then he won the election handily. So I think it's still dangerous to say this is what exists today is going to exist 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, and it should be said at the beginning of every war, there's a burst of optimism. The boys will be home by Christmas. And then there's a period where we enter reality, which I think has happened. We went high, we went low in the beginning of this week, and now I think we're entering a stable phase of reality. One of the problems here is we're all misremembering Desert Storm. If you look at the press coverage about fourth or fifth week into the air campaign of Desert Storm, relentlessly gloomy, a feeling we were bombing and achieving nothing. This just happens in war. And I think the Bush administration is not to blame for this. They have been steady. It's most of us, and I especially like to blame the armchair generals who have been mercurial and bipolar.
But I think the problem is that there are policies that they pursued that if this does not go well, and that's a huge if right now, they will have to answer for it. The boots on the ground is one of the most important, that there were forces inside the Pentagon saying there aren't enough soldiers. If this doesn't go as well as it should in a couple of weeks, that will become a big issue, and it's a political issue in the broadest sense.
In any case, one of the hardest things to find in Washington this week has been somebody who said last week that it would be a cakewalk in Iraq. Something else happened in Washington in addition to the war, and that was some action on the budget and the president's tax bill on Capitol Hill. Has President Bush's big tax cut, which by the time it was considered this week was now a wartime tax cut effectively, has it now been seriously reduced by Democrats and a couple of liberal Republicans?
It has been seriously reduced, essentially cut in half. This is regarded, and has been regarded in the press coverage at least, as a major failure for the Bush administration because they'll have to totally revamp what kind of tax cut it is. If you ask me, if you say, well, you're in a war that's expanding, you've got rising deficits, and the president still managed to get a $350 billion tax cut in, to me that's kind of remarkable.
You think the glass is $350 million full is what you're telling me?
Well, I mean, if I confess, I agree with the Bush policy on the war fervently, but I don't agree with the tax cut. I don't think this is the right time for it. But if I did, I would actually feel reasonably good.
EJ?
And I think that's right. I think that President Bush set the bar so high by asking for such an excessive tax cut that even this so-called compromise will still be far more tax cutting than Democrats want and far more than the country ought to have at a time of war. However, it is very significant, whatever happens to the tax cut, that we saw moderate Republicans use their power. You've got five senators, Senator McCain, Chafee, Voinovich, Collins, and Olympia Snow, who are finally saying, wait a minute, we don't believe in this policy. We're willing to stand up to our own party. And that was significant, regardless of what happens to the tax cut.
I want to ask you about one other thing that happened this week, which was it was the death of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a man who, it is said, somehow had more admirers and friends on both sides of the aisle than anybody else in the city. Why?
Well, actually, he had one insight, which was one of the key insights of his career, which pleased people on both sides. He said the central conservative insight is that culture is more important than politics to the health of a society. And the central liberal insight is that politics can change culture. And if you spin that out, which takes a lot of thinking, you do realize that he did combine in some ways the best of liberal thought and the best of conservative thought. He was fiercely anti-communist. He was fiercely critical of the UN when it disgraced him, but also a believer in international law. He was fiercely supporting of welfare reform, but opposed the welfare reform that came out at the end of the day during the Clinton years. So he was someone who had incredibly sophisticated views, views that were that drew on both left and right.
Proving David's point, I agree with every single word he just said about Senator Moynihan. He was an amazing man, and he was also such a character. He had this incredible way of talking that was like no one else's way of talking. He had intellectual power. He was willing, as David said, on welfare reform. Very early on, he took a lot of grief from the left because he said the family structure really matters, and the breakdown of the family is very dangerous for the poor. But then during the welfare reform debate, he sided with the most liberal members of the Senate, such as Paul Wellstone, because he thought, and using a conservative argument, that changing the system could actually make it worse. People who said it can't be worse than it is could be wrong. He also had unusual interests. You might say he was the Ralph Nader before Ralph Nader's time. He understood before anyone else did that you didn't stop accidents just by fixing the roads. You had to pay attention to what happened in the car. And that was a huge insight at the time. And he also helped rebuild the city of Washington we live in, all the reconstruction along Pennsylvania Avenue. A lot of that came out of Moynihan's plan. He was a Renaissance person. I will say there won't be anyone like him ever, but the social scientist in Moynihan said, you can't possibly know that's true.
No small thing for where we said he was a very good interview.
Indeed.
That's why we loved him.
Well, thanks to both of you for talking about politics once again. E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, David Brooks of The Weekly Standard.
Thank you.
You.